This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
In Gaza, of course, ruled by Egyptians, ruled by Romans, Persians, Mamluks, Muslims, etc. And of course, Byzantine Empire. So each one of those civilizations left its imprint in Gaza.
And that was Bethlehem University professor Mazim Komseyu saying Israel airstrikes have destroyed many ancient structures in Gaza. Details coming up. Also, two people died when a car hit a crowd of supporters of Liberian president-elect Joseph Boakai. And survivors of massive flooding 2 months ago in Libya are critical of the government response. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. The Hamas-run government in Gaza a short time ago said the death toll in the conflict with Israel has risen to more than 14,000 people. It said more than 5,000 of the fatalities are children. Also, Israel's cabinet is meeting tonight to consider a proposed deal to release some hostages Hamas fighters hold in return for Israeli freeing some Palestinian prisoners it holds. There have been negotiations for weeks over a hostage release that would be paired with a temporary ceasefire in Gaza and more humanitarian aid. Hamas fighters took around 240 Israelis and foreign nationals captive when they attacked southern Israel on October 7th. About 1,200 people died in the attack. A short time ago, South Africa's National Assembly voted to close Israel's embassy in Pretoria and suspend diplomatic relations with Israel until there is a ceasefire in the fighting between Hamas and Israel. Earlier in the day, Israel recalled its ambassador ahead of the pending vote in South Africa. Tensions have risen between the two countries over the conflict. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has said his country believes Israel is committing war crimes and genocide in Gaza. Also today, Israel's army is widening its operations across northern Gaza, where they battled Hamas militants in the crowded Jabalia refugee camp. The Associated Press said it could not independently confirm details of the fighting. A few hours ago, I spoke with journalist Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem for the latest developments. Leader of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, is saying they are close to reaching a truce agreement with Israel that is believed to include a hostage exchange of women and children. Is there a sense among people that it could happen soon?
Yes, definitely. The Israeli cabinet is meeting tonight, in fact, at 8 o'clock to approve it. And it's being seen here as pretty much a done deal, which would include Hamas releasing 50 Israeli hostages, women and children, 50 hostages, not clear if they're all Israeli, including over 4 days, so something like 13 a day. Israel agreed to release 150 Palestinian women and adolescents who were convicted of things like stone throwing and a 5-day ceasefire. During that time, Israel also agreed not to use drones to look for the hostages over Gaza at least 6 hours a day, and large amounts of humanitarian aid, including fuel, which Hamas desperately needs in order to continue to power the tunnels and things like that, will be let into Gaza. And they even say that if it's successful and everything goes well, there could be an extension of the ceasefire in exchange for the release of more of the hostages. So it's not, according to both American and Israeli officials, it's not 100% done, but it's very, very close.
And new developments every day, Linda. What is known about the fighting around the Jabalia refugee camp?
Yes, so Israel says it has surrounded the camp. The Jabalia camp is in northern Gaza and has been the scene of past very heavy fighting. Israel says that it's, you know, clearing out these areas slowly and looking for Hamas gunmen. Israel has killed hundreds, if not more than 1,000 Hamas gunmen, has arrested another at least 1,500, including those who came into Israel on October 7th. But they say say there are still thousands of Hamas gunmen in Gaza who were in this tunnel network that runs underneath the Gaza Strip.
And what has the Israeli government been saying about South Africa's allegations the defense forces are committing war crimes?
Well, they completely reject those allegations. They say that it was Hamas that's committed war crimes when it came on October 7th and murdered 1,200 Israeli, mostly civilians. And they completely reject these South African claims. And they showed their displeasure by recalling the ambassador.
And we were talking a lot about the Al-Shifa hospital, but, you know, the main medical facility, Al-Shifa, was the main focus. Now it is the Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza. Talk to us about that.
Yes, correct. There's been heavy fighting around the Indonesian hospital. There are believed to be about 700 patients and medical staff there. And, you know, Israel says that for weeks it had told everybody possible to leave northern Gaza, that it was going to, gradually take over this area. The devastation from northern Gaza is pretty amazing. Like, you know, it's going to take years before Palestinians who were living in northern Gaza and have moved to southern Gaza are able to return to their homes, if at all. So, you know, even once there is a ceasefire in place and the fighting ends, whenever that is, you're talking about a huge effort to rebuild Gaza.
And lastly, the death toll has surpassed 13,000 after weeks of Israeli attacks. The news today, what I see is 1.6 million people have been displaced in Gaza.
So these people moved from northern Gaza to southern Gaza or were displaced within southern Gaza. So Gaza is a very small coastal strip of land along the Mediterranean, and there were 2.3 million Palestinians living in Gaza. And even before this war started, Gaza was extremely poor, facing a humanitarian crisis, has been under an Israeli blockade since 2007. And now, of course, it's just a terrible situation. So people are sheltering in United Nations schools and places like that. Anybody who has a place to stay in southern Gaza or families have been staying there. There have been Israeli airstrikes on southern Gaza that has also killed people, but most of the fighting has been in the north. But, for example, UN officials say that the population of people sheltering in its schools is 9 times the maximum that they had ever planned for. So, and there's concern about a growing humanitarian crisis in these UN facilities. Doctors say they're seeing more cases of diarrhea, respiratory infections. There's concern that even cholera and other diseases could break out. And it's also the start of the winter. Yesterday and the day before was a very heavy Israeli rainstorm in Israel and Gaza. And it must just be miserable to be anywhere in Gaza now.
Journalist Linda Gratz updating us from Jerusalem. Thank you for your input.
Thank you, Yehir.
Archaeologists say the region known as Palestine and Israel is among the earliest sites of human habitation. It's part of the region known as Canaan, where the kingdoms of Judah and Israel were located. Mazim Komseyu, professor at Bethlehem University and director of the Palestine Museum of Natural History, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam some of the historical structures destroyed by Israeli airstrikes over the past several weeks dated back to before the Roman Empire.
Historical archaeological material in Gaza is very valuable because it's a cross-section of continents, and we had in Gaza, of course, ruled by Egyptians, ruled by Romans, Persians, Mamluks, Muslims, etc., and of course Byzantine Empire. So each one of those civilizations left its imprint in Gaza, and Gaza has a record of these. Let's start, for example, with the churches. Some of the oldest churches, of course, of the Byzantine Empire are from Gaza, and we find some churches like St. Hilarion or Theophilus and other churches that go back hundreds of years, some of them built right after the Roman Empire became a Christian empire about 340 AD in the 4th century AD. So they are over 1,600-year-old churches. when Islam came to the region, of course, it had built some mosques, like Al-Umari Mosque, which was just this week was bombed by the Israelis. Islam came there in the 7th century, and so the region, the people there, the Qur'anitic people, converted to Islam in large numbers and built these mosques. And some of these mosques are very ancient, very beautiful architecture, like Al-Umari Mosque in Gaza City, which was bombed. So this is about 1,400 years ago, as I said, in the 7th century AD.
What about these buildings that you were first describing? The historic nature of them is irreplaceable, right?
Yes. I mean, if you think of any modern city, like any European city, an American city, they have historical sites. They have sites that they icons of the society, buildings I consider very important archaeologically or historically. These are the pillars of the society, you know. Plus, you have the residential buildings and the buildings that are used for normal civil service, like police stations, schools, hospitals, community centers, etc. Those are all targets.
That was Mazim Komseyu, professor at Bethlehem University and director of the Palestine Museum of Natural History. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from Bethlehem in the West Bank. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. More than 2 months after devastating floods in Libya killed thousands of people and left thousands of others missing, residents still reeling from trauma are critical of the government response. VOA's Heather Murdock has this report from Istanbul with reporter Atiye Al-Hasadi in Derna.
In some places, the water flooded in like speeding cars, racing at 120 kilometers an hour over the tops of 30-meter-high palm trees. It was September 11th, the day Storm Daniel swept into the city of Derna in eastern Libya. Hani Elba, a 47-year-old government worker, saw the flood approach and mentally prepared for death. He, his wife, and 3 children were spared. But more than 2 months after the flood, authorities have counted nearly 4,400 people dead and at least 8,000 others missing, according to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. More than 43,000 people are still displaced. In a phone call from Derna, Alba says many people are still living among the devastation, with the city needing infrastructure, housing projects, and water supply projects. But mostly, he says, they need psychological support. It is difficult to determine what is happening on the ground. Most journalists were not given permission to enter Derna immediately after the floods, and many who could enter were later kicked out. Sanad Alawami, a Libyan Red Crescent volunteer who works in Derna, says the extreme trauma from the floods can be seen on the streets. Alawami says when it rains, children race to the rooftops of buildings, urging passerbys to come up because, as they say, it is starting. The mental health crisis is among Derna's most urgent needs, says Talal Bernaz, the Libya country director at International Medical Corps. But it is also a difficult issue to address. Libya lacks trained psychologists and a culture of mental health care, he says. But the trauma has become deadly, he adds, as suicides and attempted suicides are being reported at increasing rates.
We have many, many survivors inside, like thousands of survivors who lost their family members. And we need, of course, psychological aid and mental health aid as much as the physical one.
People in areas ravaged by the floods have also immediate physical needs that are not being met, adds Mary Fitzgerald, a Libya expert from the Middle East Institute, a Washington-based research institution. Derna and the surrounding region are isolated by political divisions, beaten down by years of war, easily ignored by the global community, and ripe for abuses or corruption, says Fitzgerald.
The needs remain enormous, but there is increasingly a sense that that the authorities have essentially moved on.
But the mental health crisis continues to deepen, according to Alawami of the Red Crescent, and many among the thousands of missing people are no closer to being identified. Bodies are now being found as far away as 80 kilometers offshore, and many survivors are still in shock, having never had the time to grieve. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul.
Guinea's ruling military council has ordered a probe into toppled President Alpha Condé, the country's first democratically elected leader, for treason. The move follows ongoing investigations into alleged killings, torture, kidnapping, and rape. Condé was ousted in a September 2021 coup after more than a decade in power and has been living in exile in Turkey. A letter sent to the public prosecutor of the capital Conakry by Justice Minister Alfonso Charles Wright said, "You are ordered to initiate legal proceedings for alleged acts of treason, criminal conspiracy, and complicity in the illicit possession of arms and ammunition." In 2010, Condé became the first democratically elected president of the former French colony after decades of authoritarian governments. His decision to run for a third term triggered protests which were violently repressed. After the 2021 coup, military leader Colonel Mamoudi Doumbouya promised to hand the reins of government to elected civilians by January 2026. The recent All Nigeria Editors Conference focused on the topical theme of stimulating economic growth, technological advancement, and the role of the media. Nigeria's economy is facing hard times, and Shidrek Ozoni, vice president of the Nigerian Guild of Editors, told reporter Mike Mbonye the event allowed participants to ask questions about the economy and government programs.
Well, we formulated this theme based on two reasons. One is that the nation is going through a very difficult economic challenge at the moment. A lot of things have gone wrong. The president made a lot of promises about revamping the economy. We are being given assurances that things are going to turn up for the better. But the issue is that we want to interrogate some of the programs that he has, want to interrogate some of the reasons that got us where we are, want to look at the way up. We are inviting captains of industry. We are inviting experts in the economy, also the Minister of Finance and the President of the country to come here and tell us exactly what they have. Nigerians expect a lot, not only because the president promised a lot when he was campaigning, but also because it has never gotten this bad. It has never gotten this bad. Then secondly, there's also a second reason why we chose this theme. The second one is that technology has invaded the media, so much so that a lot of them in Nigeria are going out of business. You have a lot of media losing their patronage to technology. So we want to understand how we can also plug into that technology to make money for the media industry.
The National Bureau of Statistics of Nigeria recently released a report to the effect that 132 million Nigerians are poor. Do you think that this is a worrisome trend? Do you think that this is disturbing? And what do you think the role of the media should be to assist in finding solutions to this trend?
Well, the reports about poverty in Nigeria, I even think that the 133 million that are under the baseline has gone up. The figure has gone far beyond that now, because when that report was released, it was far before the election. Now things have gotten so bad, the indices for measuring that poverty rate has gone higher than what it was. Our job as media is to reflect government's activities. Our job as the media is to also find ways of ameliorating the problem. You see, it is not enough for the government to say, this is what we are going to do. We have to hold them accountable for their actions. We have to also hold them accountable for some of the promises they made. We have to reflect how the people are responding to those programs. It is not just enough for you to say, okay, I've cancelled subsidy. Yeah, the issue is that when you cancel for subsidy, which has been one of the reasons that we are where we are today, want to also know what you are putting in place to ameliorate the sufferings of the people. Not much has been seen, according to so many people, on ground to say that the people have been given alternatives that can sustain their living and livelihood.
Let's talk about press freedom in the country. The present administration of President Bola Ahmed Tinubu has consistently said that the press in Nigeria will be free, there's freedom of expression, and that the rights and privileges of the media will be maintained. No arbitrary arrest, no detention. What's your take? What's the situation today in the country with the media, government and media relationship?
Well, anywhere in the world, there's no absolute freedom. It doesn't exist anywhere in the world. And the freedom that we enjoy in Nigeria, we have earned it over time. Don't forget that we had one of the worst military rule at a point, but the media was able to, at that point, hold their heads high. So it continues. We insist that some of those freedoms that we have earned over time is not tampered with. There was a time in the past when they wanted to introduce regulation of the media, and we have responded severally to say no, we are in a better position to regulate ourselves. That is why the Nigerian Press Organization, which includes the Nigerian Guild of Editors, the Nigerian Union of Journalists, and the Nigerian Newspaper Publishers Association of Nigeria, came together and set up an ombudsman to self-regulate. We have put all the mechanisms in place, because government, whenever they say they want to introduce any form of regulation, we insist that they can't do that, because we know it will curb the freedom that we enjoy today. But I think that comparatively, Nigerian media enjoys press freedom. Yes, because we have also earned it over time.
That was Shedrick Ozoni, Vice President of the Nigerian Guild of Editors, speaking with reporter Mike Mbonye in southern Nigeria. Officials in the Republic of Congo say 37 youths were killed and a number injured in a stampede overnight during an army recruitment drive in a stadium in Brazzaville, the country's capital. Last week, the army in the Central African nation, also known as Congo-Brazzaville, announced it was recruiting 1,500 people aged between 18 and 25. Prime Minister Anatoly Kolene Makoso said a crisis unit has been set up under his authority. Would-be recruits had been directed to go to the Michel Di Ornano Stadium in the heart of Brazzaville. Local residents told the French news agency AFP that many people were still in the stadium on Monday night when the stampede began. They said some people had tried to force their way through gates, with many being trampled in the scramble. AFP says details of the event remain hazy and it has not been able to independently verify them. 15 people, mostly civilians, were killed in simultaneous attacks by reported Islamic militants over the weekend in eastern Burkina Faso. Security and local sources tell the French news agency AFP that 3 army auxiliaries were among those killed Saturday in Diapaga, the main town in the eastern Tapao province. Kondia Pierre Yonli, a spokesman for a regional civil society organization, confirmed the information. He told AFP that schools, markets, and public services were suspended in the region today in honor of the victims. A security source said the military was carrying out retaliatory strikes. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabaro, and our engineer, Vasco Volarich, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.